everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. Here we are on Tuesday, May 6, 2014. It's the month of May. Tra-la! It's May! And is it really a lusty month, the lusty month of May? You tell me. Right now, it's looking pretty good here in New York. Fortunately, we've kind of gotten into the spring of things, finally. I think I'm going to try to sprout some kale seeds this week. And if you have any advice on growing kale, I'd like to hear about it. Maybe we'll talk a little bit more about that later in the program. There is nothing kale can't do. I want to bring on my first and only guest today, Robert Grillo. He is the founder and director of Free From Harm, a nonprofit animal rescue education and advocacy organization. Free From Harm excels at online activism, building an online community, publishing content that serves activists as well as the general public on its 700-plus page website, and syndicating its content to search engines, websites, and social media touchpoints. Grillo has a professional background as a creative consultant, integrating his 20 years of marketing and design experience into his animal advocacy strategy. He also enjoys organizing movie nights and activist events and speaks on chickens, overcoming objections to a vegan lifestyle and popular culture. And we're going to be delving into that a little bit in the next half hour. Welcome, Robert, to It's All About Food.
Thank you, Karen.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. So I'm looking forward to getting to know a little bit more about you because you're doing some amazing work.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. So just get us up to speed. Who are you and how did you get to where you are today?
Well, things started in 2009 for me with the website, and it started out as a tool for me to kind of compile resources and just kind of submerge myself in the subject matter. And at the time, I really didn't have much of a focus for Free From Harm. It was more, a diverse range of interests, anything from GMOs to animal welfare to world poverty and all these different kinds of social justice causes in between. And as things progressed, things started taking shape into an animal rescue advocacy and education site with a strong focus on chickens. As we quickly realized that that's where our strengths would lie and that chickens represent such a huge majority of the animals that that are exploited, so we focus a lot on chickens and about their issues and what we can do to bring greater awareness to chickens. And we also, of course, we cover all aspects now of animal agriculture, and we think that, you know, sometimes we'll take different angles, like we do a lot on covering dairy. And, of course, a lot of people relate to cows, and especially calves, on such a visceral level, on such a strong emotive level. And, you know, that can be one way into perhaps someone then later realizing that birds also possess many of these emotions and experiences that the calves do. They just express it differently.
Are you currently online, or do you have also a location, a sanctuary for birds?
We're based in Chicago, and we have we basically have a small urban lot. So we're not one of these, you know, farm sanctuary type of places that have these beautiful rolling hills, and it's nothing quite like that. In fact, most of what we do is rescue birds that have been neglected by backyard chicken keepers, or they have escaped live poultry markets or local poultry slaughterhouses.
Right.
And they were discovered by somebody, and we got a call or an email, or Chicago Animal Control has contacted one of us or one of our volunteer coordinators and said that we have a chicken or a duck or a goat or whatever the case might be, and, you know, they've got a week, basically, or 2 weeks before they'll euthanize them.
You go ahead.
I was just going to finish that thought by saying, to answer your question, so what we end up doing is providing them with the medical care that they need. We have a couple of good avian vets that we work closely with, and then we find them a permanent home somewhere. So we have a couple of relationships with some small sanctuaries in central Illinois.
I spoke with Karen Davis last week, I think it was last week, and of course she has a very strong focus with birds, and we were talking about International Respect for Chickens Day, which was May 4th, and the entire month is a special focus for them, and they encourage other people to focus a little bit more in May. Of course, every day should be free from exploitation for all sentient beings. I remember when I was a kid and I would ask my parents, there's Mother's Day and Father's Day, and why isn't there Children's Day? And they would say, every day is Children's Day. And and that's not even true for all children. But did you do anything special on May 4th or focusing any differently in May?
You know, I think it's great to have that, and that Karen has created that day and kind of to commemorate chickens. And, you know, like, we do it pretty much around the year. We have different campaigns, like, around Thanksgiving and leading up to Thanksgiving, about a month to 6 weeks prior. We post a lot about turkeys, and we didn't do anything as special as she did, for sure. I mean, she definitely draws a lot more attention to it than we do, but we do try.
Okay, you mentioned saving some abused backyard chickens, and I wanted to talk a little bit more about that. Now, in factory farms, the majority of chickens are raised in very filthy, confined conditions, and as a result, I think more people are interested, since they want to have their eggs, and maybe even chicken meat, there's a small but growing movement of people raising their own chickens. And
right.
On one hand, I think that's got to be an improvement over these unfortunate birds in factory farms, but apparently there's a problem with that from time to time.
Sure. Yeah, you know, the interesting thing is that Prevention Magazine in their May edition has a feature story on, you know, how pets can teach us to be better people, like, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
The article is about, and the image on the cover is a big cover image of a young girl hugging a hen. And, you know, I guess that's kind of interesting because it seems to be a sign of the times. It's like people definitely develop, you know, bonds with these birds, and even backyard chicken keepers who claim to love them and care for them, they see a symbiotic relationship with them as them giving them something in return. So, in other words, the eggs are their gift, quote unquote, to the backyard chicken keeper for keeping them. And, you know, that's the general kind of sentiment that that I hear from most of the backyard chicken movement. I'm not saying I endorse that at all. But that seems to be the general sentiment. But what happens is, and like with any, you know, with any kind of pet or companion, there's a lot of people that will get them and think that they're up for the challenge or up for the responsibilities, and then find it later that they're really not that committed. And, of course, chickens can live several years and don't lay then. They only lay for a short window of their life. So then they're not laying eggs. They're not giving their gifts, their reproductive gifts anymore.
Right, so then, and what happens to them?
What happens, and then, well, you know, they're so disposable. They're you know, people are continual, even though they, you know, they kind of develop a bond with them, they also have, you know, this barrage of imagery and kind of popular culture telling them, ah, they're just chickens, you know, they're pretty much disposable. So as a result, you know, we find chickens that have been dropped off in forest preserves, people thinking that, well, you know, maybe they can go up, make a go of it as a feral animal and survive. Mm-hmm. So that's where we've actually gotten some of our rescues. And some of them are, you know, and some but people just let them roam. And they figure they'll come back for food and shelter, but they'll actually give them free range to go out into the alleys of the streets here in Chicago and, you know, all the other perils that they could face. And then sometimes they'll get picked up or somebody will say, oh, there's a lost chicken or an injured chicken or something. And so that's how we usually hear about them.
Now, you have a background in marketing, and I think part of the problem we have today with the way we eat is we are intensely manipulated with advertising, and I'm not blaming people in marketing for that, but there's a lot behind marketing to get us to buy products, whether they're good for us or not, it doesn't matter. The point is to get them sold, and that affects our public culture a lot. So we were going to talk a little bit about public culture and its impact on our treatment of animals and what we eat.
Right. And, you know, as you mentioned in the beginning, that my background is in on the creative side of marketing, not the technical side, not the data side where you analyze market research, but on the creative side where you say, okay, here's the product or service or nonprofit organization mission, and how do we translate this? How do we give this a visual language and reinforce the mission or the message or the big idea behind the product or service? And, you know, in the 20 years that I've been working in this field, I still do some higher education work, but I don't do much outside of that. But I've really changed my perspective on this, I think, quite a bit. I entered into the field taking any kind of work that came my way. Yep. I even worked on Happy Meal boxes 20 years ago for McDonald's. And, I, you know, they were freelance projects that I would get and I would take, and of course not think too much about what I was working on. But 20 years later, I think I've become a pretty outspoken critic about the whole image building industry that I'm a part of. And I think one of the important things that I've concluded is that we've got just way too much, the public perceives way too much manipulation and condescending messages and images from advertising and the media.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's all well and good to use market data to develop strategy for advocacy and for selling a product. So, and to me, it applies to, on a commercial level, to selling a product or service, and also on a nonprofit level in terms of carrying out a mission and, you know, a strategy for your advocacy work. So it's all well and good, I think, to use market data. We should. We should know what our audience cares about. But if the truth or reality of the issue gets lost or tainted, then the advocate or marketer has a serious problem for me. And I think really what the public is looking for now more than ever is truth, transparency, integrity, and consistency from whatever the source is, whether it's a nonprofit or not.
Mm-hmm.
So that's free from harm strives for truth and transparency and consistency of message, as well as appealing to our, you know, what we call our core base of support and building that a stronger base.
You're quickly rebuilding your karma credit after working on Happy Meals.
That's right.
Yeah.
There's a lot of that to do.
Well, we need more marketing with truth and transparency. Most of it has nothing to do with truth and transparency. It has to do with selling a product, and we need more of it. And it's challenging because most of the opportunities that have money behind it are for products where you can make a profit, not for general good. Fortunately, the internet is a great place where we can set up shop for very little. And the trick is to be savvy enough to grow your community. And you seem to be doing a pretty good job.
Oh, well, thank you.
All right, you just got your 501c3. I wanted to congratulate you on that.
We did. We waited 14 months for the IRS to send
yeah,
us.
Yeah, the IRS seemed to slow down a bit. I knew another organization that just got their determination letter that they're a 501c3 not-for-profit corporation, and it took about the same time, so I'm glad you got it.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
I am, too. It was, I've been waiting and kind of collecting the mail each day, thinking that maybe this will be the day that I'll get the notice, and no, never. Not through this whole long, hard winter did it come. And
yeah.
Then one nice spring day, I guess that's kind of apropos, that spring is a time for a new beginning. So maybe that
It's a nice letter to have. We got ours at Responsibility and Living back in 2010, but we didn't launch until 2011. But it is nice to have it.
It is. It's validating for sure.
All right, so you started Free From Harm in 2009. When did you have your vegan epiphany moment?
Later in 2009. I think for a very short time after seeing films. I think films like Food Inc. were very very pivotal for me in terms of forming my ideas and acting on them. I think for a very short time, I actually kind of bought into the humane myth, and thought that perhaps I could take that route for a while. That didn't work for very much more than a couple of weeks, I remember, in 2009. And then since then, I've been vegan.
Well, let's talk about how people justify eating animal products. So you did it for a short amount of time, I guess, once the veil was lifted, but you couldn't keep up with it. How do most people do that?
Well, there's a whole class of naturalistic fallacies that, that claim we must or should or we've evolved to eat animal products. I like Charles Horn's new book. Meat Logic, Why We Eat Animals is the name of it.
Right.
His book came out shortly after we published a major page on justifications, which we consider a kind of a reference page for people. We designed it so that it would be easy to find the justification that you were challenged with and have a response with also references and resources that person could then go for more detail. So we set up the page with a real nice little menu that made it real easy for people to find your justification, and then flip to that part of the page. It's a reference. But I like Charles Horn's book. He emailed me shortly after we published that page and said, I have a book that I think you might be interested in. And I thought, boy, was I ever. I mean, it was just so salient, the way he addressed some of these same justifications. In his case, he refers to them more as rationalizations. And his book is more focused on the rational, logical appeals that these justifications make rather than the emotional ones. And I think that's really important to make that distinction because Yes, it's very much an emotional argument. Morality is emotion-based to a large extent, but if you really listen to these justifications, many of them are actually an appeal to our sense of reason. So the whole class of naturalistic fallacies that we've evolved to eat meat, or nutrition science tells us that we must eat meat, or as Charles Horn puts it, we have a gun to our head. Evolution has a gun to our head to eat animal products. These are all appeals to reason. But if we dissect them, we find, we find some faulty logic. And so we try to really address those because they're so common.
But when you face someone who has these justifications and they see them, understand them, have you seen them, does that help them change?
That's our hope. I guess our lessons from history would tell us that inevitably it must have an impact. Because I think, just in studying and looking at other social movements where the arguments became stronger from that movement, and they became better, and they became appealed to our sense of reason as well as our emotions, and they were well-rounded. As things got more sophisticated, those movements became more credible and more assimilated into mainstream culture. And so I do believe that that's an important part of the advocacy that we should be doing.
So where can I find those justifications? I'm kind of really curious to read about them.
I'd be happy to send you a link.
Yeah.
To our new page. We really put more into this page, I think, than any other page on the site. And Ashley Capps, my contributing writer who I work very closely with, helped me out quite a bit on this as well. The other thing that's kind of cool is
I'm looking at your site right now. Is it the common objections to a vegan diet?
No, it's you do a search for the word justification. It should come up in the listing.
Okay, well, if you send me the link, I'll post it on my site with this interview.
Oh, that would be great.
Yeah.
And
I'm really looking forward to seeing it.
Yeah, I'll be absolutely send it to you. Another one that I cover is it's what I call the personal choice defense. And I'm just bringing this up because this ties in with a book, a collection of essays that Will Tuttle put together. It's called Circles of Compassion, Connecting Issues of Justice.
Yes.
And what he did is compiled 28 authors and asked me for a contribution. And I picked one of my more, one of the subjects that I care about quite a bit, which is looking at this personal choice defense. And so my essay explores how people use this freedom of choice idea and moral relativism as a justification to dismiss ethical consideration for animals and some groups of human beings as well. That was pretty exciting. I was able to adapt it in a way so that it not only discussed the animals, but also how this justification is used on other human beings and groups of humans as well.
It's everything's connected. And this book, Circle of Compassion, it's not out yet, right? It's coming out sometime. There's a crowdfunding project for it.
Right. Vegan Publishers, who's a publisher, I understand, has an Indiegogo fundraising campaign. I think they're looking to raise some funds for it before they release it, and I think they're doing really well with their campaign. So it's really It's a really interesting collection of authors, and I'm very delighted to be a part of that.
Well, I'm always looking for the buttons, the way to reach people, to get them to see the light and move to a more compassionate lifestyle. It's a very, very challenging mission. And sometimes I think we're really making strides. Other times I think, whew, nothing's happening. And it's very frustrating. And so I love talking to people and find out what they're doing. I don't think there's one unique button that will work for everyone. We need a big, big toolbox. I had an eye-opening experience recently in March when I spoke to 250 cattle ranchers on how animal agribusiness affects climate change. I was part of a panel, Malone Vegan. And I learned a lot, and there were just so many things that became so clear. I'm always involved in finding out everything I can about nutrition, and most people don't know anything about nutrition. And these people were really stuck with some very basic fallacies, but they were truths to them. And I didn't have enough time. I mean, I couldn't download all of this information to get to them. There's just, we live in a world where we're overwhelmed with information, and yet many people are clueless.
Right.
Simple questions like, I talked about the 70 billion land animals that are raised every year for food, and how we should all move to a plant-based diet. And they said, well, what will happen to those animals? Mm. And, I said, well, you'll stop breeding them. And then we don't have to worry about them anymore. And just so many little things that just are not obvious.
We've covered that, by the way.
Good.
In our justifications page, I think it's probably as simple as what you just said, is that, mm-hmm. when demand declines, then the breeding, must also decline. And that's how the industry could come to an end. At least that would be our hope at some point in the future. But yeah, we've covered that, because it is quite amazing how many people are concerned with either the extinction of the farmed animals, domesticated animals today, or their overpopulation if they were allowed to become feral and take over the earth, as some people say. So on the one hand, they're extremely concerned about extinction. On the other hand, they're deathly afraid of animals, of course, because they're going to take over the world. Their populations are just going to take over. It's a fascinating kind of irrational, I would say, fear.
It's definitely fear-based, very irrational. Yeah, a lot of misinformation.
Breeding, of course, is the solution, which so many people just seem to ignore. That the problem is breeding, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, of course. It's a big... that was just one myth. One of many. And there was only so much time. But they didn't kill me. They liked me. So I got out alive, and that's good.
Good.
Yeah, so we don't have much more time, but what are your plans? You have your 501c3 now. And you have a little more clarity on what Free From Harm is. Where are you going next?
Yeah, right. Well, what we're doing is, we are very much focused on, like I said before, building our core base. And I think, It's very frustrating for many people, I find, that when they're advocating, they're not sure exactly who to approach, and they're very frustrated by the different kinds of responses they get from people. But I think what helps is to focus on those that are sympathetic to our cause and really building that core base, because those are the people that will then go out and become the champions for that cause. And if you don't mind, I'd like to cite a very good example of how this happened.
Sure.
Apple Computer and Steve Jobs. Some of your audience, and you may have seen the documentary about, or no, it's not a documentary. It's actually
the movie.
A drama about Jobs.
Yeah, I haven't seen it yet. I can't believe it.
I didn't like it too much. However, I didn't like the acting, and I didn't like the way it was staged and dramatized. However, the story itself is really interesting, and I think there's a lot to learn from the Apple rebranding story. And I'd like to just preface this by saying that I don't worship Apple, and I think that, yeah, they definitely had some negative impacts and environmental and impacts as well. But if we just look at their branding and their rebranding in the 90s and beyond, it's really something quite remarkable, I think. And what they did was, back in the 90s, people like me were Apple users, thinking that Apple was just going to crumble, okay,
mm-hmm.
because
mm-hmm.
We were their loyal followers, we were using their computers, we were graphic designers and creative people, and we just were not, they're going to Windows would just be completely insane for us, you know?
Yep.
And so we were afraid, and the media was making it sound like Apple was just going to fold. And what we didn't realize at the time was that Apple was actually staging a major comeback. And the way they were doing it was through campaigns like their Think Different campaign, where they feature people like Albert Einstein or Gandhi. And there'd be this huge, billboards or huge ads with, just that person and then the little tiny Apple logo and Think Different, those two words. And, at the time I thought that was kind of a crazy strategy. I thought, well, why would you appeal to bohemians and artists and people that have they have no power when your goal is to create more market share, right? So, but, what they did worked. What they did is they built their core base. And what they knew is that those people would become their brand champions, and they would take that message out and say, Apple is, cool, it's hip, it's an amazing product, there's nothing like it, and it worked.
Yep.
And I'm not saying that there's a direct translation into our cause, vegan advocacy or animal rights advocacy. However, I think there is something to be learned by that. That if we really pay attention to our base of people that are really already sympathetic to the cause, that we can go a lot further than trying to frustrate ourselves with people that are on the other side of the spectrum.
Well, if we're taking it from a marketing point of view, the vegetarian vegan movement did not come out with very good branding to begin with. And
mm-hmm.
I think it's over the decades has changed as the population has grown. But what do you think of vegan branding?
What do I think of it? Well,
yeah,
I think it's
the branding of the vegan.
Right. It seems to have evolved in some interesting and positive ways with. I guess brands like Vegan Cuts are cool, and some of the people that seem to be becoming spokespeople for veganism are definitely different today than they were maybe 10, 15 years ago. And so that's good, because we want people that are from all walks of life to represent that and say, yeah, you could be, a vegan can be anybody.
Yeah, so vegan can be Republican.
Yeah, you can be a libertarian. I've met a libertarian a vegan who was very passionate about both of those things.
That's good. Well, the only comment I have about the Think Different campaign, I remember it very much when it came out, and the only thing that bugged me is this move towards poor grammar. And I know think differently doesn't sound as cool. But nobody uses the L-Y anymore on their adverbs.
I know. Advertising advertising is infamous for bastardizing grammar.
Yes, and it's not just in the English language. I've seen it in other languages as well. But, oh, well,
sure.
I guess language is a living thing, and maybe those L-Y's were really just a little too extravagant, and we don't need them.
Right.
Long live the L-Y. Well, Robert, do you come to New York much?
I don't. I haven't been in so many years. It's kind of it's embarrassing.
Yes.
But I did make it to Berkeley, California last month.
Okay, that's cool. Where did you eat?
I spoke at the Conscious Eating Conference.
Oh, good.
That was a wonderful trip. And it's really hard for me to, well, it has been. I think I'm trying to change this a bit, but it's been, the last couple of years, it's been very difficult for me to get away because of my responsibilities with the rescue ARC. And being
mm-hmm.
here, having someone who can actually take over and that I can trust will do things the way I'd like to see them done.
Yes. Not an easy task.
No.
Well, all right. One last thing. Let's just talk about yummy, delicious food. You like to cook?
I do. Yeah, I'm an experimental kind of cook. What I do is I study recipes that are really well thought out with really precise ingredients, and then I bastardize them. And I basically replace ingredients, and I skip cooking methods that they recommend, and then I just create my own monster from it.
And do you make it their way the first time, or you just start bastardizing right away?
Usually pretty much right away. I mean, sometimes I just look at the recipe and I get an idea and I think, yeah, you know what, I think I'm going to replace that that white flour with oat flour or something. And a lot of times it just depends, like, what I have ingredients-wise here and see if I can find replacements rather than have to go out and shop again, because I hate shopping.
You know, I think that's a good thing to do, and I don't think you're alone with that. It's just obvious that you feel comfortable doing it, and that's what cooking is all about, being experimental. You don't have to follow every line in the recipe, and I've seen some people who really feel uncomfortable take it to extreme, like if the recipe called for a yellowfin potato and they had some generic whitefin potato, they wouldn't make the recipe. We should all just relax and have fun in the kitchen, be experimental, and most of the time things come out either edible or really wonderful.
Right. I mean, you know, I have my flops. I won't lie. I definitely have my flops, and I take responsibility for them, and I try not to impose those flops on guinea pigs or people that,
Right. Nothing against guinea pigs.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, nothing. But, I try not to subject people to my flops whenever possible, and I try to keep those to my own experiments, and I try to use the recipes that are better tested and the things that I know will turn out better on a group.
Okay. You have one. I know I said one last question before, but what's your favorite dish?
Wow.
Is there a favorite?
Can I say a dessert, or would it be?
Yeah, sure. Hey, there are no.
Lately, I just have this. I have this great craving for cheesecake. So
mm-hmm.
Luckily, there's a couple of really good places in Chicago that have amazing vegan cheesecake.
Right. And you've been eating them. Just like any cheesecake, the real ones made with tortured animal milk or the vegan versions, some are good and some are not so good. You got to find the right one. And there's nothing. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with having a good cheesecake from time to time. I have. I don't make this very often, but I have a recipe for what I call crostata di ricotta, and it's a rustic, old-fashioned Italian-style cheesecake made with almonds. It's quite good.
That's interesting. That, it sounds like something my grandmother would have made.
Yes, and the recipe is at responsibleeatingandliving.com. Okay.
Great.
Robert, thank you for joining me, and thank you for building up all that karma credit. I think you're doing great work, and glad you're out there in this struggle.
Well, thank you very much for having me on today.
Yes, may all be free from harm.
Oh, great. Hopefully we will.
Yes. Okay, take care.
Thank you. You too.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. Shall we take a little break? Why not? Let's take a little break, and I'll be right back because I've got some important things to talk about with you. Hey, everybody. Well, I'm back from the break now. It's time for the rest of this program. It's All About Food on May 6, 2014. I always make a list of things I want to talk to on this program, and most of the time, I don't get to most of the items on the list. Let's see how well I do today. Right after last week's program, we went to the filming of Dr. Furman's next PBS program. You know Dr. Joel Furman, my favorite doctor, and he's been on this program numerous times. And he's been featured since 2011 on PBS during their fundraising drives. And I heard some wonderful things, first from the people at PBS, about how Dr. Furman has helped them, and his programs have had 29,000 views, and this is really exciting, 29,000 views of his programs all about the power of plant foods, how they can boost your immune system, have you attain your ideal weight, feel satisfied and full, and it's really a beautiful message. Now, he has a new book out called The End of Dieting. I guess it's part of a series because last year he had the book out, The End of Diabetes. And I haven't read it yet, but I'm sure the information is pretty much similar to what he's been talking about for decades now. And that is how plant foods, especially the dark leafy green vegetables, the not so starchy vegetables, and beans and mushrooms and onions and raw nuts and seeds are the foods that we want to eat, because they have the most nutrients per calorie, and they're based on most of the nutrition studies are what increase our opportunity to have a quality life and a long life. So it was really exciting to be there and be a part of that. I'm not quite sure when it's coming out, but I'm looking forward to it, and who knows, I might be in it smiling in the audience. Wouldn't that be fun? So, you may know, I mentioned it earlier, we did the Lone Vegan Project back in March, and slowly but surely we are finishing up on the documentary of that event. And as I mentioned earlier, there were so many questions that people asked the panel, and I may touch on them in this documentary, but one of the ones I wanted to talk about right now was, which really had nothing to do with the subject of the panel, but it was just something the moderator felt like asking about, because the panel was talking about how animal agribusiness contributes to climate change. And he asked us about food waste. What about food waste? And we've read and heard a lot about how much food is wasted in this country. I even participated on some dumpster dives a few years ago to actually see the waste here in New York City. It's incredible how much food they put out on the streets, and some of it is perfectly packaged and clean. Bagel companies that can't sell day-old bread put out tons of bagels on the street. I mean, it's just really incredible. And I was thinking, there are a number of things that we can do to eliminate waste. That one of the panel members was saying that, he's not as concerned about waste because what he likes to do is buy a lot of food because he's not near the food stores, and it doesn't make sense for him to drive his car to the store as often to get fresh food. So what he does is he buys a lot of it, and some of it actually doesn't get eaten. And he justified the fact that he was saving fuel costs. It was okay to waste some of the food. Well, I'm always looking for the best solutions. Now, we need an infrastructure for composting because if the food is going to be wasted, meaning not eaten, then we should be putting it back where it came from, into the earth, not wasting away in some plastic bag that's going to take forever to degrade in some landfill. We need a better infrastructure. We need an infrastructure for composting, and I put that out there. I know San Francisco is doing it, and there's more focus on having this done, but it's complicated, but it's something that we need to work towards. I used to compost here at my apartment on my terrace. But again, it was complicated and I haven't done it for a while. But the other thing I was thinking of, if people find it challenging to get to the store, we talk about food deserts and some people literally live in an area where it's hard to get food. And then other people just live in sprawling neighborhoods where they have to get in their car and drive quite a bit a ways to get to a food store. And they probably have a nice car to do that in. But something that I like to do here is I buy as much food in bulk that I can that I get online. I get grains and raw nuts and seeds. I get things that I can store. And I always have good nutritious food, even if I can't make it out to get another few heads of kale. Now, the kale never goes to waste here in this household, and none of my fresh food goes to waste because that's just who I am. I'm always taking inventory of what's in the refrigerator, and I eat what needs to be eaten. But you can have dried beans stored away forever and cook them up or sprout them as necessary. There are foods that we can have always in the pantry or in the freezer or in the refrigerator that really don't go bad. I say freezer and refrigerator because I like to keep my nuts and seeds and my grains and flours refrigerated so that they stay fresh a very long time. I don't keep anything a very long time, but it's just good habit. Anyway, so that was just something I was thinking about, and I think we need to talk more about the options that we have rather than the justifications for doing things that aren't really helpful to ourselves or to the planet. And there are a bunch of things that were interesting to me in the news. You probably heard about it now. Coca-Cola is saying they're going to be removing brominated vegetable oil from their soda products. Isn't that nice? And it all happened because some 17-year-old started blogging about this ingredient and writing about it and got a lot of people behind her and became overwhelming, and Coca-Cola decided to make a change. Well, this brings up just so many issues for me. Number one is, yes, it's important for all of us to get involved and to make demands that we want good, healthy food. Now, I'm not encouraging anybody to drink Coca-Cola with or without brominated vegetable oil, but we need to be getting loud and making demands and not buying the foods that have ingredients in it that we don't like or don't or can't pronounce. And it's a shame, too, that this is the society that we live in, that companies don't think about putting the best ingredients in their products. They put in whatever will make the products last a long time, which is what this brominated vegetable oil did. It improved the shelf life because it's nice to have a product out on the shelf for a very long time so that somebody will finally buy it. And then you can take it home and have it for a very long time until you drink it. Well, no, We need to buy fresh food that moves from the ground into the store or to the market and into our homes and then into our bodies and then out, in and out, in and out, in and out. There was another study that made me smile. I'm always smiling, whether I like it or I don't. It either I smile because I just say, oh, I can't believe this is another one. Well, did you read the one in the British Medical Journal, Dietary Fiber Intake and Mortality Among Survivors of Myocardial Infarction Prospective Cohort Study? Okay, nice little study where they followed up people who had had heart attacks and what happened when they had more fiber. So they followed people, what their dietary intake was. Actually, it wasn't a specific study designed for this. They took data from the nurses' health study and another study and just manipulated the data so that they could look at fiber content with people who had reported a heart disease, heart attack, and then what happened afterwards and who survived. And they found out that people who ate more dietary fiber live longer. Are we surprised about that? I was reading this article and I thought, what's new about this? But I guess you have to be really specific in a study, and where there have been studies to talk about what reduces risk of heart attacks. Well, now this was like a follow-up saying it not only does dietary fiber improve, it lowers your risk for heart disease, but then if you've had a heart attack, it lowers your risk for future heart problems or increases your longevity. It's obvious to me, if something is good for you, it's good for you. And the other amusing thing to me in this study was they kept using the word fiber, and yet they would never say words like plant-based diet. No, they called it fiber, because I don't think people really want to admit that plant foods are really what we need to be putting in our bodies to nourish us and keep our arteries clean, keep everything clean. That was that. And I wanted to just end, because I think I'm running out of time here, on a couple of things. One is I've been making nut milk. Have you ever made nut milk? This is really a lovely thing. We all have different rhythms during the day, and when I wake up in the morning, I move very slowly, and it's a great opportunity. It's a great time for me to start preparing things. I'm kind of in this zen mode of food preparation. And this morning I had taken my soaked hazelnuts and drained them, put them in a simple blender. I don't have any fancy blenders. And mixed it with a cup of milk. Mixed it with a cup of water, strained it, and put the fibrous part back into the blender, added another cup of water. I did this 4 times, and I ended up with this lovely creamy hazelnut milk, and I'm kind of in the mood to start making all my milk. And while I was doing this, I was putting out a meditation to the cows that give so many people dairy milk, maybe not as willingly as some would think. And I thought, here it is, I'm making this beautiful hazelnut milk, and it's so much more nutritious for me and delicious. Well, join me at responsibleeatingandliving.com. You could find that crostata di ricotta cheesecake recipe there at the website. I think I'll be posting something about hazelnut milk very shortly. It's really very simple, but some people need a recipe, so I will put it up for you there. Thank you for joining me today on It's All About Food. I'm Karen Hartglass, and have a delicious week.